Welcome to Androids and Assets, our weekly podcast about the political economy of speculative fiction. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Stephen. And today we're discussing The Matrix.
Woo!
Yeah!
It's the 1999 movie by the Wachowski brothers.
And now Wachowskis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was directed by the Wachowski brothers. That's an interesting...
Yeah. Well, they mean, you know, life is long, I say.
That's true.
Power to them. It's difficult to know. Because if you definitely see the movie, like, that's definitely what it reads on it, is the Wachowski brothers. Things have been reassigned.
Yeah.
They're living their true selves, and I say power to them.
So, I mean, everybody obviously remembers The Matrix.
There will be spoilers for the 1999 film, The Matrix.
I thought you gave everyone 5 years.
This is outside of... Yeah, you have 5 years, and...
Yeah, but last time we gave a spoiler warning for an old movie, you said, I give you 5 years to see the movie, and after that I won't give spoiler warnings. But this is clearly 18 years.
I give you 18 years, and that is all.
Gets longer and longer. He's more and more worried about aggressive fans coming for his kneecaps.
That's right. Well, are you a fan if you've been 18 years without seeing the movie?
No, fans of ours.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Oh, boy.
Fans of ours who are listening to this and then go, oh, my God, he just spoiled The Matrix.
That's our legion of followers across the English-speaking world. I command you to rise up.
Yeah. Hey, we have some.
Yes.
Fewer than 10.
Yeah. Well, we're so thankful, and we're so grateful to those of you that are listening. This is more about... us and our insecurity.
The Matrix, Keanu Reeves as Thomas Anderson. There was also Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus and Carrie Moss as Trinity and Hugo Weaving as Agent Smith. This was a world in which humans had lost a war to robots, and during the course of the war, they shut down the sky.
They blotted out the sun like a GI... like.
They made permanent clouds.
Many G.I. Joe villains before them.
And robots, no longer having access to solar power, decided to use bionic power from humans. Odd choice on the part of robots. You would think that, you know, they were a little bit smarter than that.
We would just have nuclear power.
Like, or geothermal.
Or geothermal, yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of options about where you could get power from when you don't have solar. I think also in the few scenes that we see of the surface of the Earth, it's like wind torn. And
there's also a nuclear war.
So you could probably also just have, you know, wind power.
Yeah, there's options other than solar.
Though
maybe the machines,
without solar, you'd probably also lose a lot of wind. Wind would just sort of die down because you're not heating.
Convection.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of solar, like the cyclone turbines, it's like actually reflecting sunlight to generate wind, like the one, like the terminals they have in Australia. Those big pipes they stick out around, they're surrounded by mirrors, and the mirrors reflect the sun at the pipe, and then it warms the air and it moves through it, and there's just many, many turbines inside. And as the air pushes up.
Energy. So the robots decide to instead just take farm. They farm humans, calling them crops. And they're just like, they grow humans from...
other humans, apparently. This is where it also doesn't make sense.
The robots decide that they grow humans, their crops. They just have an artificial womb in which they can grow the humans. It seems like a very energy-intensive process to grow a human to then harvest them for, I'm not sure exactly what they're getting out of us, the heat that we produce. And harvesting something just for heat itself is a really wasteful process. Like generating heat, there's all sorts of energy loss in there. You're going to have a lot of seepage in other things, and entropy is just going to take over. It's a very, very uneconomical choice for energy. The robots should have nuclear energy, so they should definitely. There's fission and a lot of material on the planet for them to run reactors with. The way that they seem to be able to develop new technology, you'd think they would have solved the fusion problem, be able to have fusion energy. Like we said earlier, geothermal energy is widely available, and in terms of harvesting heat, is way better than growing humans from scratch to try and do it.
It doesn't make any economical sense, I guess.
None whatsoever. I'm also really, if they're not getting energy from outside of this system, if humans are their sole source of energy, the system would shut down eventually. You can't just keep feeding humans the remains of other humans and expand your system at all. Like, it's going to be a system that shrinks. Entropy is going to take a little bit of that energy away each time. So you'll lose... Each progressive generation of humans is going to be a smaller generation than before. Your crop size is going to shrink constantly.
You can't modest proposal that one away.
We just use the Irish.
Eventually you run out of Irish to feed your vat clones. So it's really not a great plan. Morpheus does say that they use heat from the humans combined with a form of fusion to generate electricity, which I take from that what you want.
We're just going to throw a throwaway line in
here. That is the line from the movie that explains it, apparently.
One quick throwaway, yeah. Bam, raises a lot of questions. Yeah. Why, if you have fusion, why do you need humans at all?
Well, to turn a human into a Duracell battery.
I guess it's just energy storage. Yeah. But if you have fusion, you don't need storage anymore. It's responsive. You can have as much generation as you need when you need it, regardless. They needed the humans because they needed to be villains. And we needed to have some heroes that would rise up and throw off the shackles of these robots.
Need something to appeal to the Anthropocene. That's all.
Well, yes.
We wouldn't like a story just about robots walking around a desert after humans are all gone. Bleep boop.
I'm kind of interested, actually.
I do not think friend computer is our friend. These signals are treacherous.
I think we could submit this to Sundance.
They're building tours to communicate with each other, but they realize that that's just completely been compromised by the state computer.
So, I mean, so The Matrix was made in 1999, and this was a really sort of interesting time. The internet was still quite a nascent thing. There was still newscasts asking, what is the internet and how do you use email?
Is the internet dangerous? Can the internet
Little did they know
you?
The internet is very
it's
dangerous.
Extremely dangerous.
Just not in the way they ever expected.
You had to sacrifice your phone line to get online.
I think I remember there's like a classic newscast where they're talking about emails and it's like, yes, you can email us. It's whatever, the morning show at abcnews.com/
angelfire.com.
Wow.
Yeah, so the internet was a very kind of a much different place than it is now. Certainly it was.
We didn't optimize anything back then.
Well, yeah, for whatever.
Which was interesting because data was so much more at a premium. Anyway.
That's why we only share the really important stuff. You know, Goatsy, that's 1,000 words right there. That is information dense.
Yeah, everything was text-based. It was great. It was a beautiful time.
Yeah.
I think there was also, like, Y2K was starting to be sort of a fear. Like, are computers, you know, going to be actually detrimental? Is it going to shut down our society as we know it?
Which is something now, like, I think even with the level of computer consciousness today, no one would fall for Y2K today. Maybe, I don't know, hard to say. I might be giving us way too much credit.
I think you're giving too much credit to a lot of people. There are people who will just believe anything because it's on a meme and is attributed to somebody.
Well, this is interesting, I think, because I think like things like hackers and viruses were extremely novel as well. And very poorly understood. And I think in a way, this sort of like this presentation of hacker culture and hackers and what can be hacked, kind of like anything can be hacked. And, you know, and this is along with other stuff in the culture has kind of helped facilitate the Russiagate narrative today. Like when people are like, what is this term like hacking an election or like hacking American democracy? What does it mean? Like when you drill, like, you know, it's just a very vague term. A lot of people just kind of uncritically accept because it's technical and strange. But when you drill down into it, what most Russiagate people are talking about is buying Facebook ads, conventional broadcast media like RT and Sputnik, you know, just like, and then just on top of that, just people in Russia pointing out glaring contradictions within the United States itself, which I don't think is a crime. at all.
No, and I think a lot of people though. I think a lot of the money spent by the Russians, there's estimates that it was like $1 million a month or something like this. But it was spent on someone who would sit at the computer and pretend, would adopt multiple personas, generate content, and share it amongst various groups. And that's hacking now. Like, they didn't have to actually hack into anything.
Yeah.
They just had to appear as normal Americans and share information that may or may not have been true. Because I think, like you said, a lot of the stuff they pointed out was actually accurate.
And in which case, how is that hacking?
Yeah. And so it's kind of this, I think it's interesting that we're saying they hacked the election, and it's more like hacking. It's not hacking in a way of infiltrating a secure computer location, but it's like hacking the American consciousness. Like, we thought the American consciousness was secure, and they found a way in and found all of the of the insecurities in the consciousness.
It turns out it was their own racism and imperialistic ambitions, greed and perversion. Turns out that was their vulnerability the entire time. And the notion that the U.S. doesn't do this all the time to literally everyone, including Canada.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, comical.
Yeah. I mean, this whole notion of Russiagate. I'm sorry, Russiagate's a huge trigger for me. I'm like, this thing is insane, and you can't keep going. It's a neo-McCarthyism.
Explain to me how it's a neo-McCarthyism.
Because it becomes the Russians have a secret technology that we don't fully understand that is being used to subvert our will and our sovereignty secretly. It could be anywhere. Anyone could be a Russian. And then on top of that, then there's this whole notion that there is a secret subversion and that there are all these people who are sympathetic to the Russians in our midst. And Mueller is now calling people up and doing things like that, like this woman in Georgia who ran a Trump Facebook group who has been indicted by the Mueller investigation. Like, it's just crazy. Just like calling on people and intimating they have Russian links is sufficient enough to be damaging. It's exactly like what happened in the McCarthyite era with communism. It's a total moral panic about something that doesn't even exist.
But we do know, though, that the Russians were spending money to try and influence the election.
Oh, okay. Like,
are you denying that?
I say it's irrelevant. Because what does this woman in Georgia have to do with it? What does Trump have to do with it? Like, what does, you know, General Flynn have to do? What does Mike Flynn have to do with it? None of this has anything to do with any of that. That's just a whole other thing. And if Russia chooses to do that, what are you going to do? You can't stop them. You can't fight them. That's not a conspiracy within the United States itself. Because the thing that ties on the thing in the Mueller investigation is that there is an element inside the United States colluding with the Russians. If Russian state or Russian companies buy Facebook ads, that is not a conspiracy. That is not a conspiracy. And that's not like you can't in like, so what? Like, and again, the United States does this continuously to other countries and is now increasingly doing it to itself as well. Right. Like, you know, Radio Free Europe. Right. Like, and like the Foreign Press Corps in the United States and like all of these things that intentionally are designed to build propaganda to distribute to other countries. And in fact, the United States actually has a law that says Radio Free Europe content cannot be distributed in the United States by American media brokerage because they know it's propaganda and they get in trouble for it. Right. Like, so like the fact.
So.
Like, I mean, Russia operating this is not an internal U.S. problem, right? And so the thing, and that's why it's crazy, because now they're going after all these Americans for supposed collusion with Russia. And the only hacks that ever actually happened were the hacks of the DNC and the Hillary Clinton server, which have not been connected to Russia in any meaningful way.
No, yeah, they may or may not have been. Mm-hmm. Who knows? That's not clear yet what's happened there. But I've understood, and maybe this is. Maybe I'm completely wrong. They're interested in the corruption within the Trump campaign and the White House, that there are lots of ties, particularly business ties, with Russia.
Sure. Well, there's this meeting with Jared Kushner and the Russian lawyer.
And Jared Kushner's family and his company taking lots of money from two different Russian sources. Flynn seemed to have business ties with Russia.
Well, no, the Flynn stuff was about Israel. So that was the indictment, the Michael Flynn indictment. This is the whole thing. So much was made of this Michael Flynn contact with Russia. In the end, the Michael Flynn contact with Russia was actually it was a violation of the Logan Act, which is like the thing that no American can subvert the sitting president's foreign policy, which is an insane law. It's a crazy and unenforceable law. But anyway, basically what Michael Flynn did is Obama had put the go ahead for the United States to abstain from the upcoming Security Council resolution to condemn Israel. And so basically the Trump camp was rushing to kill or delay that resolution against Israel on Israel's behalf, because the Kushner family is very much linked with Netanyahu's party in Israel. And they're big Zionists. Plus, they were also courting Zionist money, because that was up for grabs after Hillary Clinton. Anyway, so basically what happened is Michael Flynn was actually approaching Russia to try to persuade Russia to kill the Israel condemnation in the Security Council, which Russia didn't go for. So it's Israel gate. It's not Russia gate. And if you want to talk about like foreign money spent, like Qatar, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, IAPAC, and like all these Israel, all these groups in the Middle East of various stripes, all shovel significantly more amounts of money directly into U.S. politicians' pockets. And we're supposed to be scared of some Russians advertising for Black Lives Matter. And that's the thing that tells you this whole narrative is crazy, because Black Lives Matter ends up being painted as this Russian, how people who have meaningful concerns and questions about the U.S. regime get branded as insane, as Russian agents. And that's the other way. It's a McCarthyism, because all of these dissenting voices are all trying to break our unity. They're trying to weaken our resolve. Is Trump mobbed up? Hell yes. Is Trump corrupt? Hell yes. But every time the Flynn investigation finds something that points to corruption that is not Russia corruption, they turn the other way. And they don't actually go after any of the real corruption, because they're looking for a Russia connection that does not seem to exist. But all this to say, like, I think the concept of hacking is super mythical. And certainly you see that in, like, hacking is very much spiritual. Like, Neo sort of metaphysically hacks his reality to become, like, the one, right? He attains, like, transcendence through, because he is in the real world before kind of waking up to the Matrix.
He has an alter ego of the Neo, as Neo. And he's a hacker as Neo. He has a career that's very much just a regular, boring office job where he's Thomas Anderson.
He's an IT professional of some sort.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, but I mean, there was lots of times back then you would see hackers, though, you know, just like typing ferociously and battling other hackers. Like, oh, the hackers are coming in, but I'm defending against them. I'm putting up walls as fast as they're tearing them down. Like, really? What?
No. This is all a lot of work that went on way beforehand. It's all about the programs you have and the processing speed that you have and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think they show hacking. They've moved away from that sort of depiction of hacking as sort of an active attack and defense, as if hackers deployed armies of hacking.
It's not playing Magic the Gathering.
Yeah. But then, yes, you're right. Neo is able to somehow hack the Matrix near the end of the movie, when he dies and is resurrected with Trinity's kiss. She says, no, you're the one. And he wakes up and now has the ability to completely rewrite reality in the Matrix. So he's hacking the Matrix, but now he doesn't actually have to do anything for that hacking. He doesn't need to be at a terminal. He doesn't need to be, because he's already connected in. So his thoughts alone are enough to completely subvert the system.
He's had the realization of non-duality.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's like the most dual thing ever, because he has like a physical body on the other side, but whatever. I always think it's really funny, like the talk of like the role Buddhism plays in this, because like you kind of see it. It's like it's kind of there. There's like this whole non-duality piece, like, you know, a oneness sort of thing. But it's also like it's pretty strictly binary, and it is tremendously Cartesian. In a sense that there's a real world and there's a world of lies, you know.
I think there is no spoon, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
like the way that I bend the spoon is by realizing that there's not actually a spoon here. So what is it? Yeah. I'm not bending the spoon. I'm just changing my mind about what I'm actually seeing. Mm-hmm. Somehow that also changes your mind about what you're seeing.
Well, there are problems of other minds. Yeah, but again, that all gets subverted when they say, oh, that was just a dream. Now this is the real world. And they never actually get in question. Well, I guess in the subsequent movies, they maybe get into questioning the integrity of the so-called sort of Nietzschean eternal recurrence thing in this whole science of history. We won't go into that. But yeah, cyberpunk.
There is like a lot of discussion around religion and Descartes, and the whole movie is really an examination of Descartes' evil demon.
The first thesis or the
How do I know that any of this problem is true, or how do I know what is truth when everything that I experience is being fed to me by something else? Well, I know that I exist, and so my existence must be true. And that's sort of Morpheus is like red pill, blue pill. Like, yeah, you have to exist.
That's the cogito ergo sum right there.
Yeah.
I think therefore I am, right?
I think there's other religions sort of baked throughout it. You mentioned Buddhism and
a lot of Christian.
There is a lot of Christian mythology sort of that messianic shows up, and you need that one hero. And I think later in the films, a lot of that becomes much more overt. It's sort of, they set it up in the first movie. But yes, cyberpunk, like you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's just chock full of references to awesome things. Like, you know, like, I don't think you don't get a Matrix without Neuromancer and Transmetropolitan, Invisibles, and, you know, and
Snow Crash.
A whole bunch of golf. Yeah, Snow Crash, and a whole bunch of just like goth culture. And like a whole bunch of goth and S&M culture, which is also a key ingredient to the Matrix.
Yeah.
Without German rivet heads, you don't, you never really get the Matrix, I don't think so.
Yeah. It's interesting. Once you know that the Matrix isn't real, all of a sudden you start wearing like long dark leather jackets and dressing in all black clothes, and your fashion sense just goes right out the window.
Yeah, it was a huge boon for, I think, for goth culture.
It was quite accessible, The Matrix.
It's a huge movie.
Yeah. Lots of people saw it. It was very popular, you know, a really wide distribution. And cyberpunk sort of up to this point really was based on some fairly obscure novels. Not a lot of people that were reading these things. I mean, yeah, Philip K. Dick and William Gibson and Neal Stephenson,
they were like famous.
Huge names and famous, but being a famous author is often very different from being a famous movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, like developmentally, being a preteen at the time, was very significant in my development. I think as a nerdling, a proto nerd, larval nerd, nerd pupa, maybe. I don't know.
In some ways, I mean, I'm sad when I see the legacy of this film being co-opted by like men's rights activists. You know, they call themselves red pillers because they're choosing to take the red pill and see the world as it really is, while the rest of us are still just trapped in the Matrix. Come on!
Oh, yeah. They made Descartes so simple men's rights activists can understand it. And that was a mistake.
I love The Matrix. I still love The Matrix. I like to go back and watch it. It's still a really fun film. At the end of the day, it's just a kung fu movie.
Yeah.
With some layers on top of it, right? They develop new technology, and I think a large part of the legacy of the movie is sort of within the film industry, where they pioneered some new techniques for filming or for developing.
Bullet time and slowing down.
They had bullet time and they
wrapping
had
around
wire foo and really like that 3D filming where mm-hmm. like the cameras would move and you would see things. Yeah. This one scene from multiple angles was really like new at the time
and became a standard. Yeah, and also I think it was also a Chinese co-production actually, because there was a lot of co-production with China on The Matrix, and now we're in an era where there's just seamless Chinese-American co-production, which we've talked about on the show before.
I think there was also, when the DVD for The Matrix came out, Blu-rays, were they around yet? Not quite.
I mean, we're a few years away. I mean, DVD was in 1999.
Maybe
VHSs were still, like, you could get The Matrix on VHS.
The DVD was popular, though, And it was one of those feature rich experiences that you could like stop the movie. Yeah,
had a lot of liminal and a lot of liminal content.
And do some of that 3D-ness of your own, or like there was parts where they would like, we filmed this in 3D, so if you want to review it, like you can make the camera move yourself, and
yeah, there's a lot of texture, I guess, which has been completely erased from media consumption now. But yeah, it's very unique to that time. I also want to talk about like how like in The Matrix, the bad guy is the system.
Mm-hmm.
And how, I mean, the 90s was a really interesting time because you had this, it was this era of post-war consensus. So kind of like, you know, Russia was on our side now. Communism wasn't really a thing. It was all just sort of like the Western liberal transatlantic community just sort of guiding the earth as they saw fit. There was no grand narrative of Islamic terror. Francis Fukuyama very famously declared that, you know, this capital, late capitalist liberal era was the end of history, and that this is just how people were going to be, and things would just globalize and integrate and sort of enter into a new era of humanity. Yeah, he's recounted. He's really gone back on that, but, you know, people were thinking that. People were thinking that. And so actually in that kind of space where there's no big villain over there, I think the questions about what we're doing and who we are was starting to creep in. It's interesting because I think in April 1999 is like the start of also the intervention in Kosovo to like the United States, and the transatlantic community begins to intervene in the Balkanization of the former Yugoslavia, and they start bombing Serbia, and there's troop interventions, and there's Christians killing Muslims killing Christians, and what is I think just a very dark time. Columbine happens I think that same year as well, 1999. Is your Columbine happens, and The Matrix gets weirdly dragged into that also, or 2000 is Columbine? Yeah, 2000. But The Matrix gets dragged into that because they're part of a group called the Trenchcoat Mafia, and they like The Matrix, so the moral panic that followed that.
It was very brief.
Simple times, really. Simpler times when no one thought to blame the guns yet. yeah, so it was a very, I think, a very interesting time, and sort of this birth of like the system and this notion that maybe the enemy, the real enemy, kind of lies within. And when I talk about like that being formational to me, I think it's important. Like, it was a time when we had maybe the space to look inward a little bit. And I think that's important for us, for the people who were alive at that time and the people who were shaped in that time, to maybe, we got to keep bringing that forward. We got to keep bringing that up, because like stuff with like Russiagate and all sorts of things where they're trying to reassert this, you know, in the West, there's this reassertion of this, no, a multipolar world is bad. No, China and Russia not wanting to be encircled by a ring of U.S. military bases is evil. really has got to be questioned, I think. And I think The Matrix is really in that, as much as the system is very vague and like with human rights activists can be co-opted in a whole lot of ways.
You're right, though. Like it's easy to co-opt it, to say I'm fighting the system. I'm like Neo.
Yeah, and anyone could. And it was actually a really cheap thing to say.
Yeah.
What
system are you fighting against? Yeah. And
but I think in the 90s there was actually a great clarity about what that was, and it was
global hegemony.
Yeah, like capitalism. It was it was the Battle of Seattle stuff. It was people rejecting capitalism's role in their lives and all these kinds of things. And that very quickly goes away when all of a sudden there's bearded scary men on the other side of the funny swords threatening us, and we forget that.
Yeah, I guess some people do.
And then activism, you remember Kony? Was it Kony 2012? Kony 2010, remember that, when like the Lord's Resistance Army, and there was like the whole slacktivism thing, and it was like, and then when did dissent become baying for the blood of a militia on the other side of the world? You know, like when did that become meaningful dissent? We've lost our way, I feel, in this journey to understand what it is we're up against. Capitalism and the security state has very successfully leveraged a lot of popular dissent back against progressive themes. How can anything with the Clinton name on it really be a meaningful resistance to capitalism and hegemony? I mean, it's not.
Well, I mean, they're not resisting capitalism and hegemony.
They're resisting the Trump camp.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's
a resistance.
That's not meaningful for people who want to actually change things.
Sure, but people who actually want to change things don't identify with that camp at all.
No, or shouldn't.
From what I can tell, very few real resistance are like, oh yeah, we're with the Hillary camp and the Clintonites and we're resisting. No, they're the ones who are really being active and resisting and trying to change things are the ones that are encouraging the more than 400 women to be on the ballot this year. They're the ones who are
Black Lives Matters, Antifa, like those are the people who are doing, I guess, the real work. Yeah, but again, no one sees that. Like, I feel like that gets lost in the hubbub.
Yeah,
because there's all these never Trumpers who are. That's why we should be scared of Russia.
So The Matrix, 1999 movie, maybe some foreshadowing in there for what we see in the world today. Early understanding of the interconnectedness that the internet brings us. Music this week was provided by an Ant and an Atom, and we're available on Google Play, on iTunes, and on Stitcher. Basically, wherever you want to get your podcasts, you can find us.
If you have an obscure podcast carrier pigeon system you want us on, let us know. We'll get on it. We can do that for you.
Yep.
We'll try anyway.
Please do subscribe. Helps us know, you know, if people are actually listening. Leave reviews and comments to help other people find this podcast, because I think it's pretty great.